You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, March 16th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Washington Post political correspondent Dave Weigel, why the Dems are fighting for labor in Alabama. Also on the program today, Seneca Savoy of the Austin DSA and Homes Not Handcuffs. Meanwhile, a Democratic senator accuses the FBI of doing a fake 2018 background check of Brett Kavanaugh. We'll ask the moms. Meanwhile, a record number of unaccompanied immigrant children detained as the Biden administration scrambles for a solution. More EU countries suspending use of the AstraZeneca vaccination. Meanwhile, the deadlier nature of B117 variant has now been confirmed. As investigations continue, half of New Yorkers poll against Andrew Cuomo resigning. That poll will change. 12 Republican states have now adamantly refused to expand Medicaid, denying millions of their people health care, despite it including a massive financial windfall. They make money off it. New poll, vast majority of Americans support a $15 minimum wage. The owners of Purdue Pharma up their settlement payment to nearly $4.3 billion. But don't worry, the family will retain billions. Calls begin for Justice Breyer to retire and Spain to experiment with a four-day work week. Yes, please. Lastly, U.S. Jesuits raise $100 million. For reparations to descendants of slaves. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Also joining me today, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma. How are you?
Hello, Sam. I'm doing well today. How about you?
I'm doing okay, too. You said that as if you don't say that every day. You seem to be doing well every day.
Well, I mean, I feel like I said I was doing well yesterday. I had a bit of trouble with daylight savings time, I've got to say. Yesterday, I felt like I was kind of in a dreamlike state.
Yeah, I think it's taken 2 days to catch up with me because I'm feeling a little bit of that today. But hope springs eternal. I mean, we'll recover. I like it better. I feel like they should make it permanent. Every time daylight savings comes around, there's always seems to be at least a couple of lawmakers who are like, we should do this permanently. And I'm all for it. I think we're past.
Light later as opposed to light earlier. I mean, the light helps me get up in the morning. So that's what's difficult.
Yes, I do. I do like it later in the day. Yes, without a doubt. Because it keeps my kid sleeping, too. And so he doesn't wake up the moment there's like a pinprick of light coming into the room. But so, yes, I'm all in favor of keeping it like this. But we'll see. I think we'll probably go through another year where people will say it's a good idea and then we won't hear anything else about it. But
we need a time lobby to buy off our politicians.
Matt, you're in on the extend the keep the daylight savings, aren't you?
I mean, I like it in the fall, but I hate it in the spring. So I'm kind of tied between both poles.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of my take too.
I feel like wasn't it? It's it's theoretically to give farmers more time, right?
But I think that's a wives' tale. I don't think that's actually true.
It's not. It's not actually true.
I don't think so.
What's the conspiracy that creates it? I mean,
big clock. I think
big. It's a Big Ben who is influencing. Well, that's over in the UK. So
nobody can figure out why we're doing it. I would say let's just leave it as is and not fall back. I'd like that extra hour, but I'll give it up.
We should just keep falling back. Let's just fall back every time.
2 hours. We could start the week and then just add an hour every day so that we get an extra hour of sleep every day.
I think that math works.
Let's check this out. One of the few great things that came out of the Trump era was that Larry Kudlow got his TV show back, I think. And right? Didn't he get his TV show back?
Well, he got a new TV show. Wasn't he on CNBC before? And now he's the replacement for the very unhinged Lou Dobbs, who got kicked off because he was spreading
theories.
He
get the same TV show back, but he got a TV show back.
He got his hour, I think, or he got his slot.
Fox business. So he gets to show up on all these TV shows. And Kudlow, and I did his show a couple of times when he was on CNBC back in the day. His answer for everything was cut taxes. Well, he's back on it. It didn't seem to necessarily do very well for us with the...
He didn't learn any new tricks in the
Trump
didn't
learn any new tricks.
No.
Here he is with Laura Ingraham. And this is in response to the reports that we talked about yesterday briefly, that the Democrats are going to be looking to increase taxes on wealthy people and corporations to levels in a way that we haven't seen since 1993. That Janet Yellen was floating the idea of an international accord to get a baseline for corporate taxes so that all countries could raise their corporate taxes without getting engaged in a race to the bottom in terms of trying to attract industry. So here's Larry Kudlow on with Laura Ingraham, spreading the fable that the way you raise tax revenue is by cutting taxes on corporation and wealthy people.
Tax damaged wealthy people also. This business about paying their fair share, the way you get upper income people to pay more in taxes is lower their tax rate. Not only will they have investment incentives, they will also have no tax avoidance. So they never tell you that. But the evidence is very clear. And to say this is just big corporations as though they were bad, or they're going to take away the deduction for small businesses too, they're not bad. That's just a straw horse. It's a red herring. It's a Trojan horse. This is democratic social policy, redistribution. And all it will do, Laura, all it will do is take a good recovery in 2021 and stop it dead in its tracks in 22 and 23 and beyond if it gets through the Congress.
It's a slippery dilemma. It's a false slope. I'm just going to mix them all up in a jar and see what comes out.
I mean, aside from his inability to deploy some basic idioms, the idea that if we lower taxes on wealthy people, they will not engage in tax avoidance and they will pay more taxes is absurd on its face, because they don't care what the tax rate is. They just don't want to pay a certain amount of money. They're not going to pay more money because they don't have to pay as much in taxes. It doesn't make sense.
Is he saying that they're going to donate their money to the government? I mean, that's the only way it could generate more revenue. But he's just retreading and desperately clawing at 40 years of failed trickle-down economic tropes that is just, you know, regurgitating in his brain.
Indeed. And as far as the idea of lowering taxes and driving revenue, you really only need to say one word to dispel that myth, and that is Kansas. People can go back and look at Sam Brownback's Kansas, where he brought in the original godfather of this concept that if you lower taxes, you will get more tax revenue, Arthur Laffer, who developed the laughable Laffer curve. And they brought him in. They cut taxes. They cut taxes on individuals. They cut taxes on corporations in Kansas. And lo and behold, what happened once they cut these taxes? They actually got less tax revenue, so much less tax revenue that they had to cleave huge parts of the Kansas education, public education, Kansas higher education. And so much so that they ended up, a Republican legislature ended up raising taxes, and Sam Brownback, they basically jettisoned him into the ether by appointing him during the Trump administration as a way of basically burying this narrative. They appointed him to be ambassador to faith. That's not a joke.
I know.
He's literally appointed to ambassador to faith and then never heard of again. Like, they kept him floating somewhere in the atmosphere, I guess, because they didn't want this story of Kansas to get out. And I have to say, it's a failure of the Democrats to have not
exploited it more. Well, it's good PR by the Republicans, if nothing else, right? I mean, and again, just the Kudlow way of thinking. They tried this in the Trump administration. They said the tax cuts would pay for themselves, knowing that they wouldn't. Less taxes on the wealthy means less tax revenue. You don't need to be an economics major to understand that. But it's pathological at this point. Kudlow's got no other mode because, you know, it's just, it's like a greed-soaked mind.
Yes, he has one tune. He sings it over and over again. And I got to say, it's done him well. He's been fairly successful with it.
The best people get
it's
rewarded.
Kept him soaked in many ways.
Indeed.
Well, soaked in different ways, yes.
We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Washington Post political correspondent Dave Weigel back in a moment. Meanwhile, here is Emma's favorite advertisement that she likes me to read here. This is
Hello Tushy.
Exactly. 2021 new rear, as it were.
No, it's new year, new rear, Sam.
Well, that's the way it should be. New rear, new year, or new year, new rear. Look, in 2021, don't just make a commitment to wash your hands every time you poop. Go the extra mile, wash your butt. That's right. It's the brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment. It's finally here. It is stylish. It is eco-friendly. It is super easy to install and affordable. Hello Tushy doesn't just cleanse your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself. Cleans itself before and after it's used with the Smart Spray automatic self-cleaning nozzle. It attaches to your existing toilet. It is super easy to install. It requires no electricity. It requires no additional plumbing. It cuts toilet paper use by 80%. And sanitation is simple. The Schmutz Shield offers easy cleaning, and the knobs are naturally antimicrobial. Plus, every Hello Tushy bidet attachment comes with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. You can upgrade to the new 3.0 model if you're already hooked on Hello Tushy. Or if you're new to the revolution, join millions of happy customers right now. Have a clean butt with every flush. I've told this story a million times now during the height of the toilet paper scare. Our buddy Kyle told me that he went all in on a serious bidet. And he said it changed his life. And I was like, I'm not ready to make that kind of commitment. And sometime around then, Hello Tushy asked if we could advertise. And I was like, I'll try it out. And there you go. It has fundamentally changed something that we all do. Let's put it that way. And somebody who had the idea, made the point last time we read this, I can't remember if it was an IM or what. Like, you don't just take a dry piece of paper and wipe your hands if you get something on it.
I believe we had a call or an IM.
All right. That's what it was. That was a perfect example. You use water. So go to hellotushy.com/majority, get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners. Go to hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off HelloTushy.com/majority. Remember, 60-day risk-free guarantee. You're going to want to try this out, folks. Lastly, if you're a business owner who's hiring, as you know, a lot of challenges just in general hiring new folks, certainly during this era. It's hard to organize. When you get all these applications, it's hard to find the right people. And now, you know, you don't get a chance to meet them in person. You do it over Zoom. But it definitely helps to make sure you got the persons with the right skills. And that's why hiring can feel like you're trying to find a needle in a haystack. You can post your job to some job board, but then all you got to do is hope that the right person finds it. Well, this is why you should try ZipRecruiter, and you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent out to over 100 top job sites with one click. And then ZipRecruiter's matching technology finds people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. How do I know this? That's how we got Brendan. Brendan was invited by ZipRecruiter, found it. We had a bunch of qualified candidates. It was just the top one. In fact, ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. True. It's no wonder over 2.3 million business owners have come to ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. So while other companies overwhelm you with way too many options, ZipRecruiter finds what you're looking for, the needle in the haystack. And right now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Once again, remember, go to this unique URL, ZipRecruiter.com/majority, MAJORITY, ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. When you become a member on the Majority Report, you support the free show, you get the free show commercial free, and you get the fun half. Now, I would like to welcome back to the program, Dave Weigel, Washington correspondent for the political correspondent for the Washington Post. Dave, how are you?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm doing well. So I see you're outside. That's good.
I am. I'm in Los Angeles, which is not D.C., which is awesome. I would recommend it to anybody who lives in D.C. to get here for a while. Yeah,
I can imagine. Yes, it would be nice. I'm waiting for the sun to come here. All right. Well, so, Dave, you're out there. Obviously, you're writing the trailer. There is no campaigns right now.
Yeah.
Or at least no political campaigns, more or less. And you're covering some of the stuff that some of the pieces you've written have to do with what the stimulus means for the next mm-hmm. campaign. I want to talk about that in a moment. But you focused in on the Democrats sort of like actively engaging, or at least more so than we've seen in the past. And that's sort mm-hmm. of the point. With this union drive in Alabama, where you have a union workers in Bessemer, Alabama, trying to unionize their Amazon warehouse. So what's the story? Why are they engaged in this? And at some level, it was a story in the Times today. I don't know if you saw it yet. I know it's early out there. That the way that the lessons that were learned from the stimulus in 2009 have been deployed today mm-hmm. By Democrats. And there was a little bit, I guess, you know, the Obama people were a little bit upset that they were in some way sort of criticized for the way they responded. But talk about this in the context of the union.
Yeah, it's not brand new for Democrats to be this invested in a labor drive, but it's newer than people think it is. So when Joe Biden taking the lead of, you know, Bernie Sanders and this groups that have been organizing around this union drive, Joe Biden listened to them, recorded this video saying, without saying the word Amazon, it's up to you whether to form a union or not. Don't be intimidated. That was kind of a high sign for a lot of Democrats to invest more in this. So you've got Alabama Democrats putting time and resources into advertising the drive. You had a delegation of House Democrats go down. You just basically have this confidence. It was all some of this was happening at the same time the PRO Act passed the House. This confidence with Democrats in just being actively pro organization, organizing pro labor party in a way that they kind of got away from in the 90s, right? I mean, so much of Democratic trauma is based on losing 1980 and undoing everything the party stood for over a couple decades. And so much what we see in the last couple months, to a surprising extent, if you didn't vote for Biden, if you thought that Sanders or Warren was the only candidate who would do this, to a surprising extent, you know, Joe Biden, age 78, rethinking all these concessions Democrats made to get away from welfare payments, to get away from unions. Like, this was just the biggest example. Talking to people in Alabama, like, no one could remember a president being this adamant in favor of a particular union drive. I think they had to go back to the 40s, really, to find one.
Yeah, I spoke to one of the organizers of that of the union there, and he cited Biden support as being very helpful as to what they're doing. Well, let's walk through. I mean, because let's just start with the Sanders campaign, because the Sanders campaign, I don't know if people remember this, was not just campaigning. I mean, they were actively engaging in union drives around the country over the course of the campaign. I mean, they had sort of integrated it, and sometimes they were deploying their email lists, right? Just remind people of that.
Well, that's really important. So Faz Shakir, who was the campaign manager that of the Sanders campaign in 2020, he joined then. He would talk to me about this, that every time you send a campaign email out that's not raising money for you, you're using that list to you're burning out maybe somebody who gets it to give attention to something else. And they use the list multiple times, I think dozens of times, to promote some sort of union drive or a strike. It was pretty frequently there is a strike happening. We support the striking workers. And look, that the effect of that in the primary was to kind of goad people like Biden into doing more. I mean, sometimes Biden would hog the credit, right? There was this shop and save strike in Massachusetts. Warren and Sanders were pretty out early in favor of it. And then Biden showed up. And then on the trail, Biden would start talking about how I showed up at this picket line. But the lesson was taught and learned, that this was what Democrats wanted to hear from the people ready to lead them. And I mentioned Faz because this group, More Perfect Union, was founded, like, not a lot of fanfare after the 2020 election. And that's one of the organizations that just, with not a ton of resources, went in and one, used his connection to Ron Klain to say, you should pay attention to this Amazon drive. He already was paying attention, but kind of talking through what impact Biden would have. And two, just, you know, talking to workers, putting out videos, creating content that, because the problem for a lot of union drives, speaking generally, is it's not just that people might want to form one. It's that they are told from their employers, even if they're not getting fired, it's going to be a lot of money being, you're going to take out of your own paycheck to give to this group. It's a lot of effort. It might fail. Why even bother? So trying to create a sense of solidarity momentum has been a goal of Sanders campaign veterans. And that's kind of through osmosis gotten to Biden and to the rest of the Democrats.
Well, when you contrast it too with how, and hi, Dave, good to see you.
Hey, good to see you.
When you contrast it to obviously the Obama administration, the last Democratic administration, you cite the efforts or really lack thereof, I would say, during Obama's tenure, even when he had a supermajority, the Free Choice Act, right, or the Employee Free Choice Act. The Democrats didn't even fight for that in the slightest. Can you contrast that with what we're seeing right now from Biden's leadership? And even though Obama had, you know, I'm going to put my walking shoes on rhetoric during his campaign, similar to how Biden talked big about union support during the campaign.
I mean, that was the surprise. Like, so you just mentioned it. Obama had this line. I remember the one, when I went back and looked for the exact quote, the one I saw was in South Carolina, which he won huge, and said, you know, if you guys are on the picket line, I'm going to get some walking shoes and walk there with you. And people said,
soft walking shoes.
We're going to take it literally. And he never did. So the same promise from Biden rang pretty hollow until, I mean, he has not walked a picket line, but this is exactly the sort of thing that labor wanted Obama to do. And you know, Emma, you talked to Democrats in these primaries post Obama, 2016, 2020, that was a real problem for labor. I mean, one, they had members who drifted away from the Democratic Party because they said, okay, what do these guys actually do for us? You know, it was different in states where the Republican Party was all in a right to work. But generally, the guy made promises. Where are they? You know, unionization is still declining. And also just I think the political mood still, even though Obama was a fairly young president, came out of, you know, 80s and 90s politics and not the 70s. There still was this shell shock of, you know, you're going to alienate people you need if you're just all in for labor. You know, the Chamber of Commerce is going to come and smash you. So what happened instead was the Chamber of Commerce just kind of rolled them. FCA never had 60 votes as is, but one mistake Democrats made in 2009-10, I mean, people have been writing about how they have looked back and regret it. The big one probably is they just didn't utilize reconciliation the way they could have. They could have passed another reconciliation bill after Obamacare. Could they have put FCA in it? No, they could have put some other forms, but you're right. They had this bill. Most Democrats were for it. It had passed the House when Bush was president. And when they needed just to find, you know, convince Arlen Specter, or convinced in this couple month window where they had 60 votes, it was not a priority. They did not schedule a vote. They did not push it. I don't think that would happen today. I think that there was a window where it was clear Democrats had the votes and it wasn't clear how long they'd have. Look at it now. I mean, look at the pressure you have on name a Seventh Circuit judicial nominee. Right. That was not a thing that people organized around. No offense to the people who did shout about it. There were a couple, but it was not. If you went just consumed your normal amount of news or you watched MSNBC, you just kind of said, let's give the ball to Obama. I'm sure he's doing the right thing. You didn't say, look, you told people that you were going to pass this bill. Where is it? So you're right. The Biden administration put out a statement saying they support the PRO Act, which is a bit more than was done with EFCA. And then you have in the Senate, it's not clear what the steps will be, because you can dodge a lot of this by saying, well, we don't want to break the filibuster. But the fact that they're trying is very new.
And I want to just remind people that not only did Obama say that, but there, you know, in 2011, when Scott Walker assaulted unions in Wisconsin, I mean, this was a ready made opportunity for Barack Obama. And he said nothing. It was as if it didn't exist. And it was a massive, massive story. This theme, though, there's two halves of it, right? There's the Biden half of it, and then there's this sort of like the era and all that means in terms of not giving Biden the benefit of the doubt or not giving him an extended honeymoon, however you want to phrase that. The fact that you do have people who are going like, hey, Breyer's got to resign. Well, you got to pick judges for the Seventh Circuit. We are monitoring who Merrick Garland is picking to fill out the antitrust division. There's just so much more scrutiny, informed scrutiny, and what I mean, there these factors. You know, I guess we could spend hours trying to figure out like what developed. But part of it is, I think it seems there is so much leveraging the mistakes of 2009, from all sides, it feels like all players within that world, whether it's from the outside or the inside, they all are using it to leverage what they should do this time around.
Absolutely. I think Benji Sarlin from NBC likes to compare this to the movie. I forgot the title. They retitled it, Live, Die, Repeat. Edge of Tomorrow, I think it's called, where basically, you know, Tom Cruise keeps reliving the same battles, and then because he's relived it, knows what to do the next time. This is only their second time getting to try it. But Ron Klain was there in the White House during the stimulus as a Biden advisor. He's now the chief of staff. It's rarely do you get I can't even think of another time when you've had people who were watching from, you know, the second row and thinking about how the first row was getting it all wrong, got to be in the first row and make all the decisions. So that's been a gigantic factor this whole time. And the whole aspect of Obama and his legacy here is interesting, because Biden was a defender of Obama's legacy during the campaign, you know, almost protesting too much about it, right? Any kind of criticism would be made of something that was left unfinished by Obama, or most frequently you'd hear this with the, you know, deportations, and he would just rise up to defend Obama and criticize people for talking trash on Obama. This was I think, very effective in keeping black voters who ended up deciding the nomination behind him. So Biden's like the only guy who can do this. And you see, there's a good New York Times story today by Estelle Herndon about some of the Democratic thinking about this. I wasn't going to say debates, because you kind of, most Democrats are fine with saying, yes, there's more we can do than we did in 2009. You've got a couple people like your Valerie Jarrett and Rahm Emanuels who resent this, but they don't run the party anymore. I mean, Rahm Emanuel's out of the cabinet. He's commenting on ABC News. There's this slow realization that the people that the left blamed for stymieing the Obama administration when it could have done more, not like asking for something impossible, but doing a thing that could have passed or could have gotten budget reconciliation, they just don't have the ear of this White House. So I feel like no one wants to be naive and say they fixed it, because that leads to disaster. But this level of pressure moving a White House is kind of new. I mean, it's, go back to how Bill Clinton operated in the first few months, or how Jimmy Carter did, and the story of like Democrats taking power like Biden did is they have some ideas, they immediately scale them back, and they get rolled. Now, so the minimum wage has been scaled back. Obviously, that's one thing he wanted to do immediately that he hasn't done. The immigration bill the comprehensive bill is not moving as fast as they promised. But look, Obama did not. This is one of the things you heard again and again from Latino organizers, that Obama said he'd have an immigration bill in his first 100 days. He totally could have. Something could have passed in 2009. He didn't even introduce it, whereas Biden has introduced it. So that's like a common theme of this presidency, is we're going to try the stuff that the quote unquote professional left was telling us to do. And when they've bailed on it, it's been, well, we don't have, you know, enough votes to break the filibuster on this one. I mean, minimum wage is kind of the example, or if you thought we had 50 votes, if we broke the filibuster, we actually don't right now. Is that convenient for them to dodge that fight? I mean, definitely. But I think it stands out that the other things they said they were going to do and try, they actually did them, which is new. Every other Democratic president gets in and immediately scales it back. I mean, Bill Clinton couldn't get a $16 billion stimulus bill passed with 56, I think 50, I think it was either 55 or 56 Senate Democrats, and they just whiffed it. And Biden has not.
I think the conversation is not over about the filibuster by a long shot at this point too. And I want to talk about, you know, the way that they are using the stimulus, because I think that is also another example of this, where they're actually going out and politicking on something that they did that is good. But before we get there, I'm very curious about this. So Faz, you write, that Faz approached Klain.
Yes.
And you say Applebaum, congressman from Alabama, also flagged the drive for the White House. Like, what do you have a sense of, like, how does that work? I mean, like, is this the thing that, like, the Biden administration is like only vaguely aware of this and they don't understand the import, or is it they don't want to engage in it? And then they have to be convinced to engage in it. Like, what is that dynamic?
Well, I mean, so a good way to think about this is the Trump administration versus the Bush administration, right? So George Bush gets in there. He has a collection of conservative appointees. A lot of them are Texans who he knows. But if you're just like a David Bossie, or you're a conservative activist, you don't have a direct line. I mean, you can get something in front of them, but not until Trump do you realize, oh man, all I need to do is go on Fox News and say, let's pardon this guy who, you know, shot up a village in Iraq, and the president is watching and he'll listen. You had a direct line. People had lines to, you know, record the Akrula Landowskis and the people in the orbit who were not the kind of people who took power when Republicans won before, and they were this time. And so without a lot of activism, I mean, like, there weren't marches in favor of building the wall. It was just that people had to, they could kind of push an open door, and they had finally a Republican listening to them. I think a version way less giving than what I just described is happening with the Biden folks. It's just that the people who know the Biden team are able to get the ideas in front of them where they weren't. You know, compare getting something in front of Ron Klain to getting something in front of Rahm Emanuel. I mean, famously, he just was really arrogant, really dismissive of the left, thought most of what the left was asking for was a waste of time, even judicial nominations. He was annoyed that people would keep bringing that up to him. And that's not how these people operate. I'm not trying to venerate anyone. I'm just saying it's different now, that there are people in this administration who have relationships on the left. Even the comms team, you know, includes people from Move On. It's just a more connected to, I'd say, the left generally. And then some of that's kind of the more soccer mom liberal left. Some much less of it is the Sanders left. But it's true that Biden gets along really well with Sanders, and he has people in his team who get along with Sanders' team. And that was not the case under Barack Obama. So a lot of this is personal relationships, and some of it is the constant activism. I mean, having a big primary where Biden didn't bend on a lot of stuff, but having this in his face again and again, I think really did have an impact on them saying, okay, here's what you have to do in order to keep people in the tent. I don't know. I mean, I haven't got the sense that people are having, street parties over everything Biden does, but I was in Louisiana last week for a story. There is a special election coming up for Cedric Richmond's seat on Saturday, and the early voting was last week. And it was just weird. I had been so long since I talked to a bunch of Democratic voters, because it's without getting too much into it, there's a guy in the race who's endorsed by Richmond, is running on his connections to the White House, and there's people in the race who are running as outsiders. And the voters I talked to were like, yeah, Biden's doing pretty great. Like, I'm really happy with the way the country's going. I really think this administration is doing good things. We send somebody there who works with them, awesome. They're just, there wasn't the same frustration that I saw like immediately under Barack Obama that wasn't really ever getting to the Obama White House.
Well, I mean, so Gary Chambers is running in that race, right?
He's one of the people. Go ahead, sorry.
No, I'd just be curious about your thoughts on that, but I know we don't really have the full amount of time. Mm-hmm. I'm curious too about how the kind of Democratic, not resurgence, but renewed focus on mm-hmm. the South is playing into this. I mean, you said you were down in Louisiana. We saw the wins in Georgia. We saw the Democrats delivered when they promised material things to voters and it worked out. And, I mean, the checks are $1,400, but I digress. I mean, and then of course, what we've been seeing, in Alabama as well too, right? Which is the deepest red state you can think of. But mm-hmm. there seems to be an understanding by Democrats that we can't just really ignore these states going forward. And a lot of that is connected, I think, to Black voters as well. Can you touch on how that's informed this union, pro-union stance from the Biden administration?
Yeah, well, and one thing we haven't mentioned yet is the American Recovery Plan Act. I mean, I still wish I had a better acronym, but it includes this, I'll just use neutrally the word bailout. It includes like all this free money for union pension plans. That was the kind of thing that unions just never got to the table on, in certainly not under Trump. He did one bill for coal miners, right? And he took all the credit because that's what he did. But yeah, they've oriented themselves much towards these like movements in the party, and the fact that states like Arizona and Georgia came on the board, a lot of that had to do with the deep organizing. These are, you know, not heavily organized states, but you have in those states building trades and retail workers and health workers, and they were super organized and they got taken seriously. I mean, the story that the Stacey Abrams, I guess, is the avatar of all this, because it's the easiest story to tell and it's the most impressive turnaround. But it was about finding all these people and convincing them, no, actually, we'll be like a deliverable if you elect us and you send us into power. So that is new. And I don't know how to scan across like the whole Midwest, because there's a lot of stuff they did or they ran on that they think will benefit the working class white guy who just bailed on the party for other reasons. I mean, the Republicans, it's very telling that the two issues they've kind of honed in on are the Keystone Pipeline and immigration. Both of those are kind of not the reasons, if you live in Ohio, that like your plant moved. And if you work in an auto plant, you don't care about the Keystone Pipeline. If they move the plant to Canada, it's not because immigrants are here. But so it's clear that Democrats have just more of a story to tell based on, and again, I sound like I don't want to simp for them, but it's just very different from the old attitude they had, which is that we're going to run on stuff and we're going to ignore the organizers and activists because they're always whining and they don't know better. Like getting, you know, rinsed in the Midwest once and losing voters they never thought they were going to lose made them more attentive to labor. I mean, that's one thing I remember in the campaign, is there would be these labor forums and people really had to show their work. You know, they had to prove that they were actually going to support labor because these guys had watched their members drift toward Trump, and they couldn't name anything Democrats had done for them recently. Like, the fact that there's no discussion of a new trade deal right now for a Democratic president, that's fairly new. Again, Clinton and Obama were big into using trade as like a foreign policy, wide-ranging just a thing that was less about labor than about like global economics. That's gone. So I don't know if it could come back. It's just surprising to watch them govern this way.
There just seems to be a lack of outright hostility towards major segments of the party. I mean, this is on some level, you know, what we're sort of like applauding is like basic coalition politics, you know, without, but so let me ask you this. If the likes of Rahm Emanuel are not, and it's not just Rahm Emanuel, right? I mean, there are a legion of mini Rahm Emanuels who work in that sort of universe. Like, who characterized to me, like, who are staffing these things? Like, when you show up, I mean, there's thousands of people who work in the administration, right? We end up hearing about the cabinet secretaries and then maybe a layer or two underneath that. And to a certain extent, it feels like it's sort of split between sort of, you know, mainline Democrats, if you will, or establishment Democrats, not necessarily ones that are hostile necessarily to the left, but some who are certainly sort of dipped in that come from different waters. But then there seems to be others. How would you characterize those people? Like, whose universe are they from?
I kind of know what you're talking about, but which?
Well, you say like, you know, the Rahm Emanuels don't have you know, claims here. But so whose universe do who do?
It's good. They're just, some of it's just that they're younger. So, I mean, there's people in this team like Emmy Ruiz is running politics at the White House, and she was a Hillary campaign veteran. And so on paper, people might look at her and say, oh, well, Hillary campaign, I know what that's about. That's about never only doing incremental things not wanting to do politics. But it's kind of this cohort of Democrats who came up in the Obama era and watched them get like lose everything and get so disappointed are just more aggressive about doing one, spending money, making people know that what they benefited from, and then advertising it. So it's there weren't that many Rahms. I mean, the thing that I have not unraveled is that Bruce Reed, who was there in the 90s for under Bill Clinton, who was there for Obama, one of like the original neoliberals, is still in the Biden administration, and people were kind of waiting for what's the sellout he's going to pull that's going to pivot back to you know, austerity. There just hasn't been one right now. Even what they're talking about this summer, if they do an infrastructure plan, they're talking about raising taxes as part of it, knowing that they're going to raise taxes on the wealthy and that Republicans will be against it, not the Clinton style. And Bruce Reed was there for this. Well, the deficit's a problem, so we're just going to everyone has to suffer. We're going to cut benefits and we're going to raise taxes. Just no one talks like that anymore. And if there were Democrats who still believe this, I would talk to them. But even Manchin isn't on that path. I mean, if Manchin was a 90s style austerity Democrat, he just would have bailed on this bill, right? He wouldn't have voted for it. So I think it's just a collective traumatization of this entire class of Democrats. And some of them were more moderate and worked for Clinton or, you know, worked for John Hickenlooper. I mean, John Hickenlooper's campaign spokesman worked for AOC now, and her beliefs have not changed. Like, she just, the strategy is different. So I think it's just been kind of a move left in the party. And that's one of the things when Republicans will say, like, this party move left, I'll say, well, like, that's inarguable. It totally has. Republicans have moved right, Democrats have moved left. The Republican critique is just weird because instead of attacking the things that all the left energy is based on, they're attacking left-wing stuff that's, like, not happening. You know, so they're going to abolish the suburbs. They're going to get rid of Dr. Seuss. They're not really attacking the main change here, which is that liberals rediscovered, like, LBJ style, not the bad LBJ, but the original popular LBJ style of, like, Keynesianism and uplifting people by giving them money. And, like, they're all on the board now. It's weird.
Isn't that a confirmation of what the left has been saying all this whole time? Is like, they can't, if you actually implement the policies that 5 or 10 years ago they said that you were implementing, they can't really attack those because people like it. I mean,
yeah.
You know, we've watched, you know, I don't know, a million Fox news segments where they're like, well, of course. I mean, if you give people money, they're going to be happy. And yeah. It's like, well, okay, maybe we should be giving people money and make people happy. Like, I mean, it doesn't have the staying power. I mean, that's why, you know, that's why McCarthy is at the border right now saying this is a crisis. And everybody's mm-hmm. going like, well, not the kind of crisis you think it is.
Yeah, but that's kind of a good Republican tactic generally that's worked before is this president took over and something else is happening that he ruined, you know. And it's tough because so many people's attention is fixated on the pandemic, not on the border. It really isn't. I mean, the reason they're going to the border, it's kind of like the Onion headline, Marilyn Manson going door to door to shock people. Like, they're really angry that the media is not rushing to the border. I mean, and people are covering it. Like, press is covering it. But they're trying to make that the thing Americans care about and talk about. And it's proven to be kind of tough without Trump as president driving all the attention that way. But you're right. I mean, both sides have done this, though. If you talk to Republicans, I did this around CPAC. I was talking, like, Matt Schlapp, who runs ACU at CPAC, has been around forever. And I was asking him, like, what's some stuff that you thought was too, I didn't say too far right, but what's some stuff that Trump ran on you thought was too unpopular? And he's like, oh, immigration. Like, I thought we needed a different strategy and we couldn't run on a border wall. And he was right. So we do that now. And I feel like the same thing has happened on the left where even if they're not gushing and admitting it, some of them are. I mean, some of these Democrats are saying, like Ron Klain, that the left was right about this. Like, they were shouting for us to do more stuff and we should have done more stuff and now we can. I think it just happened in a big way with a lot of people at once, which kind of, I wouldn't say it surprised me, but I think it should, there was definitely some takes. I remember David Sirota had a take last year about how Biden wanted to get elected and do austerity and people were dragging him. And I disagree with Sirota sometimes. I was like, nope, his take was based on what Biden and his advisors had said. It's like, had there been no pressure on them whatsoever, who knows what they'd be for. But they just kept staffing up and hiring people who felt otherwise. And, you know, there were these erratic stories where does Biden want like a new deal or is he going to tack it in? It was unclear where he stood, but people just convinced him that you needed to spend big and he listened. I mean, it is just Biden being the central figure on this is really weird. If you know his history, you know how much he talked about like deficit reduction and spending cuts and all of that for most of his career. It is very strange that he's doing this, but he is. So that's the question we're figuring out now. Like, why?
I contend the guy has always been a cipher. And so it's really, look at which way the wind is blowing and then you'll know which way his sail is going to unfurl.
I think that's totally fair. And that's what I thought Trump would do more of that because he had just gotten into politics with just heterodox, I'd say, beliefs. That's to be generous. For example, like he seemed to be pro-gay marriage and stuff and said, I'm pro-LGBT. And then because his base demanded it, he's like, all right, I'll sign off on all these anti-trans orders, I guess, and like appoint a bunch of anti-LGBT judges. But I thought he would do more shifting towards what was popular. What he did instead was shifting towards what his base wanted, which is not always the same thing. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's not. The thing with Democrats is what their base wants is really, in many cases, economically, super popular. Is like, decriminalizing border crossings popular? That's not. Is, the Hyde Amendment, getting rid of that and the government, quote unquote, funding abortions? That's not popular. But on the economics, like the left has been screaming, like, everyone wants this stuff. Like, look at the minimum wage ballot measure. Like, does it ever lose? No, it doesn't. Like, why are we not doing this already?
Let's, I want to ask you, and you know, and maybe we'll have to do this next time because we're out of time. About where we're headed on the $15 minimum wage. Chris Coons was out there the other day saying, like, there were two provisions I didn't like in Bernie Sanders' bill, but mm-hmm. I'm still interested in the $15 minimum wage. Do you know anything about that? Is he just like, what is he talking about?
I don't really know what he's referring to because the minimum wage bill like phases in over time. And I don't think it's not $15 until 2025. And I'm from Delaware. Like, that's not a state that would be crippled by a $15 minimum wage by any means. I don't know what he's talking about. That did sound like blowing smoke. I wouldn't write off this, discussion they're having now where Democrats want Republicans to get on board for a like $11, $12 thing. But this is where I think the left's pressure on the filibuster is important. if McConnell believes there is a serious chance of Democrats changing rules and passing something, you know, he just starts screaming. Like, if you do this, we're going to blow the Senate up. We're going to pass concealed carry. We're going to do all this. So if the left just said, I guess we're done with this. This is why sometimes on Twitter I'll get frustrated. People who say they didn't do $15 minimum wage in February, so they never intend to do it. And I was like, well, you should never, you know, compliment Democrats for failing. But like, if you leave the field, there's no pressure on anything happening. If you just say, like, I guess they never intend to do this, then Republicans will say, phew, I mean, they left. Like, there's lots of things in the Obama era that they could stop caring about because people stopped agitating because they gave up. And so I think there actually is in Chris Coons's gut, like, the idea of a $12 minimum wage is not offensive to him. I don't think I've not interviewed him about it exactly. I talked to him when he was running because he had a DSA primary challenger last year. He was for raising it. He didn't say how much. So I would see if that actually works. But I feel like the role of people continuing to demand $15, and that's basically the entire labor movement. That's part of this, right? Like, this is all social welfare from, like, you know, Otto von Bismarck to today is, there are people agitating for something that's a 10. What if I give them a 6? You know, that's just generally how this works.
Right. I find it hard to believe that there is really, at the beginning of the administration, beyond like the COVID relief bill, that there was a settled plan for any of this. And I think they're responding to, you know, like I say, I think Joe Biden's a cipher. And I think the idea is that, like, you know, they're going to, if they get good feedback on certain things that they do, they're going to follow that course much more than some type of ideological, you know, Joe Biden agenda. I mean, he may shut the doors to certain things, but I think we will get a sense. Yeah. But certainly it's going to be a function of how much people push. Dave Weigel, always a pleasure. Folks, check out the trailer. Just Google Dave Weigel, the trailer. We'll also put a link at majority.fm. As always, a pleasure, Dave.
Thanks. Good talk to you guys.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Seneca Savoy of Austin DSA and Homes, Not Handcuffs. We'll be right back. Okay, well, I want to welcome to the program Seneca Savoy from the Austin DSA and Homes, Not Handcuffs. Seneca, I'm sorry, we have a couple of minutes here. Thank you so much for joining Emma and myself. Tell us about Homes, Not Handcuffs.
Yeah, I'll try and give the fast version of this, since usually this is like a talk I've given a million times. So Homes Not Handcuffs started off as a coalition to decriminalize homelessness here in Austin, particularly three ordinances that have been in effect since 1997 to 2019. Those were no sitting, no lying, and no solicitation. So it was a Class C misdemeanor from the time I was homeless in high school until 2019 for you to sit down or lie down in public. For you to ask people for help or money in public at certain hours, and then to sit or lie down with your possessions, which is what they call camping, but includes sitting or lying down with your backpack, falling asleep in your car, etc. These things had up to $500 fines, and 90% of the time, those fines would turn into warrants for arrest. So you'd literally be arresting people for being too poor to find a place to sleep. So in 2019, we knocked a few thousand doors and got a unanimous vote at City Council to roll back these ordinances. And immediately, the chair of the local Republican Party, that's Matt McCoviak, founded an organization called Save Austin Now with one token Democrat who's not in any clubs to reintroduce these, right? And so the main purpose here, like the fact that it fucks over homeless people is incidental to them. The primary purpose is to juice Republican turnout, right? So that's how they got their one QAnon member on Austin City Council was through ginning people up around this and to, you know, kind of further roll back criminal justice reform in Austin, right? Austin is the city that had the largest reduction in budget during defund summer last year. Just elected Jose Garza, who is probably one of the leftmost district attorneys in the country, also an Austin DSA member. And you know, there are a lot of people who want to put a lot of effort. They're raising $500,000 to try and pass this thing in a May election that'll probably have 25,000 people voting.
Wow.
And so we're trying to stop. The main things that we need as the pack we put together is real simple fundraising. We're able to get a lot out because we have so many volunteers. Over our first few weekends, we've now had over 150 people volunteer in terms of phone banking, friend to friend organizing. We're going to have our first kickoff canvas. We just got 20,000 pieces of lit coming in. And so we're going to do, as Austin DSA, our first canvas since Super Tuesday of last year. We already have, 53 people interested, right? In the middle of COVID to come out. We have a lot more. Of course, most of your listeners are not in Austin. So the big thing is, if you're able to throw in a few bucks to our pack, we're incredibly efficient because we are spending 100% of that money on getting tools for our volunteers, like auto dialers that allow us to talk to a lot more people, lit so that we can go knock on doors, that sort of thing. And we need to talk to about 20,000 folks, right, in a relatively short span of time.
All right. Well, thank you. I mean, that's pretty tight. So, all right. Well, first off, what's the website? I want to make sure that we mention a way that people can get in touch with what you guys are doing, because we should say that, hey, obviously this is, Austin, it seems to me to be on the forefront of these type of initiatives. I know over the course of the summer, they also, like you said, cut back on some of the police budget and then also bought some hotels to provide housing for folks. I mean, these are very important programs that hopefully will create models for the rest of the country. And so maintaining what has been built in Austin has huge implications for people around the country.
Yeah, I very much agree on that, right? If this passes, right, if Prop B goes in the books, not only is it terrible policy that is going to ruin thousands of people's lives, right, especially when these eviction moratoriums roll off, is the first thing. But second of all, it's going every single time we have a city council vote, in the back of every council member's head, they're going to be like, I don't want another Prop B on the ballot, right? And so they're going to want to not kick the hornet's nest. And we're in a good position, right? Independently of the Homefront Handcuffs effort, there has been a systematic attempt to canvas and recontact people who are supportive of defund during last summer. And that's incredibly successful, right? Tens of thousands of people have now been talked to about what actually happened during the budget last year, why it's good and what it takes to continue that. And if we want to capitalize on that momentum, right, have 30,000, 40,000 people call in the city council again this year and have it matter, we can't have this hanging over our heads. Also, we won't have as much budget, right? Because if we're spending more money, the police overtime generated by these kind of nuisance laws just eats up the budget. We have the best paid police in the entire state right now, and they get paid hourly. Right. So if you add this incredibly onerous activity that they can spend a lot of time ticketing, then, that is taking away from what budget we'll have available during the next negotiation, et cetera.
OK, so the website for people to go to, and we will put both the website and the Act Blue page in the description of our YouTube and our podcast. But so people hear this, noonprop.b2021.org. That's a very straightforward site. No on prop b2021.org. Not only should you visit, donate, and your time, maybe your money, that's also, if you're an Austin resident, that's the way you should vote, is what you're saying with that URL. Remind us again when the election is and what you think the chances are of pushing this back. I mean, it sounds like you guys have already just hit the ground running.
Yeah. So the initial polling amongst likely voters was slightly tilted in their side. Now, when we go to Democratic voters, it shifts significantly. right? So overall, of course, in a May 1st election, you expect a very rich white electorate. And I would expect that if we held the election tomorrow and it was the people who would vote on May 1st with no one telling them to vote, then Save Austin Now would win definitively. If we switch to Democratic voters, then it shifts significantly, right? So we get among all Democratic voters about 56% in our favor. If we go to voters who are between the ages of 35 and below, right? So 18 to 35, then we're crushing them 60 to 20. So the turnout piece is really important. Now, of course, all of that polling was prior to Snowbird, right? So there was a period where like tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of people in Austin had a week of what it feels like to be homeless, right? No power, no water, et cetera. So we don't have polling after that, which could be a pretty significant shift in people's opinions.
Well, it's no on Prop B 2021, no on Prop B 2021. Seneca Savoy, I wish we had more time, but we'll have you back to get an update in the future. And we will be very explicit with the time zone next time. And appreciate your coming on, though. Really great stuff. I wish you luck.
Thanks.
All right, folks. For Emma and I, that's it for us today. We will see you tomorrow.
Just kidding.
We'll see you now. Exactly.
Psych.
Wow, that no on Prop B 2021 is they got it together, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they have really that is great organizing there.
Yep.
And you know,
Austin is an organized city.
I was about to say Austin's just like paving the way for the rest of us leading down there.
It'll be interesting to see too, because you know they're inviting all these tech companies to come down, and they're basically building their second home from the Bay Area in Austin because of these tax rates that the state offers. But if these local people organize in this way, I feel like that could be quite a fight.
Yep, it'll be interesting to see. We will get updates on that for folks going forward. Joining us in the fun half today. No Me Key will be joining us. Do you switch that just for me?
I do.
That's very kind of you. That is very kind of you.
This is the first time you've noticed. It's been like a year and a half.
I have noticed, but it just occurred to me. Like I just saw you like typing, and I realized like, oh my God, she changes that for me. And because in the past I was like, wait a second, it hadn't even occurred to me. But now I realize, yeah, you just it's like. Literally, you just change that for me, and then you have to change it back to normal when you're with normal people.
Basically, I used to put it in it might still be in my Twitter bio, but this was, you know, story of my life. Sam, you're not the first. I know you want to feel like you're special, but the reality is many, many, many Americans have had this issue.
That makes me feel a little bit better. Folks, can check out your show today at 3 p.m. Is that not correct?
It is at 3 p.m. Eastern. Even with the time difference, I know people are getting a little confused over that. The same time, guys. Stays the same time. Do you find that too with your show? Like,
Are getting confused that we don't abide that your show doesn't abide by daylight savings time. I mean, it's
really weird, actually.
I think we have to as a society.
Well, no, I mean, what I don't understand is I got messages from people saying, like, is it still at 3 o'clock? I'm like, yes, everything's still at the same time. It's just the time changes.
Wow. These people,
quantum physics.
What have they been doing in the past when we did daylight savings?
I think COVID has really changed people's perspectives on
it
time.
It certainly has mine. I'm just fried. I can't wait till spring. I just that's it. I'm done. I'm like
you have 6 days.
Well,
not like real it. Spring.
Yeah,
it's like.
All right, well, folks. Matt. What's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
We're recording a new Literary Hangover this weekend, but on Thursday night we'll be talking with Victor Pogge of The Intercept about Lula being free or being free to run, I should say.
And Griscom interviewed Seneca and probably had a lot more time to talk to him, so folks can check that out, right?
Yeah, that's on the TMBS YouTube page. Go check that out. I believe that's public on the YouTube page. Yeah, I talked about the success defund had in Austin.
Oh, okay. All right. Good stuff. And just a reminder, folks, you can support this program by becoming a member. Join themajorityreport.com. Join themajorityreport.com. Reminder.
Like the stream.
Like the stream. Poggers. We've got all sorts of crazy ass emojis going on in on the Twitch stream.
Do you have a Harvey K one? Because I just learned we have a Harvey K one on our Twitch stream.
I think that means we don't know everybody anything about does. It. But I'm not sure because I have one, and it and people like can do it on other people's chats.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you can't. You know, you may have created the Harvey K, but you don't. You don't own it.
Wait, it's not proprietary.
You can't contain him.
Yeah, you can't.
You cannot contain Harvey K.
Harvey K is public domain. Obviously,
maybe we got to get a new. Maybe we got to get like a super Harvey K. Emoji. We like our emoji team is just. I'm sorry. Is the emoticons that we got? It's just too good. Have you seen Emma? Have you seen the one with you with the thumbs up?
I have not. I've seen the one you sent me. It was like 40 of you, and I think I wasn't. But maybe that was the wrong thing.
No. There's a new one of you where you're doing this.
Oh well, no. But that's inaccurate. I did this.
I know it. That's why we corrected it.
Oh. Or I know I did this. I did this.
You didn't see that, Noam? You don't know what we're talking
about.
No,
I don't.
No, I...
It's worth hearing the story.
I put it on my Instagram. You might just want to just
look it up right now.
Yeah.
Do you guys get offended when the emojis people pick for you are not very attractive?
Do I?
No. I haven't even seen emojis people seen pick you. For me.
Like, is...
I got one
of the chin's really big.
I was on the subway, you know, early on living in New York, and I got kind of scammed by somebody who was like, let me draw a picture of you. And I didn't realize I'd be charged after. And I have the picture still. I look like Sarah Huckabee Sanders with like bags under my eyes. So I was like, this is offensive.
Is your hair big? It's the
hair
charcoal
big.
On your eyes.
Yeah, lots of charcoal. So yeah, and then the guy was like, "That's $20," and like, "Well, I don't want it." So it's also insulting.
All right. Well, we're gonna go. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code Majority, get 10% off. We will see you in the fun half 6462573920. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous? You're a little bit upset? You're riled up?
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's a good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-5014-57. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an
idiot.
That guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird.
No way!
Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Tim, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.